Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Sue Sisley, president of the Scottsdale Research Institute, dedicated to conducting empirical FDA-approved studies on the efficacy of the marijuana plant for treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder in veterans and others. She outlines the odyssey she's had to endure to gain approval for her research. Lori Robertson also checks in. The managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Sue Sisley, president of the Scottsdale Research Institute, on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Sue Sisley, Arizona-based physician practicing internal medicine and psychiatry, president of the Scottsdale Research Institute. Dr. Sisley is the site principal investigator in the only FDA-approved randomized control trial in the world examining the safety and efficacy of the whole plant marijuana in combat veterans with severe post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. An early adopter of telemedicine in her practice, she's an institutional member of the American Telemedicine Association. Dr. Sisley earned her medical degree at the University of Arizona College of Medicine and completed her residency training at Good Samaritan Regional Medical Center in both internal medicine and psychiatry. Dr. Sisley, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Oh, thank you for the invite.
You know, as a nation, we're in this midst of several concurrent public health issues. We have this huge unmet behavioral health care need. And tragically, we're experiencing an epidemic of suicides in our nation's veterans population. And we're also in the throes of a deadly opioid crisis. And you've experienced the confluence of all of these firsthand. And I'm wondering if you could talk with our audience about the scope of the problem, especially the lack of effective treatment options for the larger sector of this population, and how it galvanized the focus of your research in examining medical marijuana as a vital untapped resource.
Yeah, I would start with the issue that, you know, we don't see a ton of pharmaceutical innovation, especially around the problem of PTSD. So there has not been a single new FDA-approved medication for PTSD in 17 years, if you can believe it. And the only two medications that have actually been approved by the FDA specifically for treating PTSD is Zoloft and Paxil. And so when those medications don't work, inevitably these patients get, you know, pummeled with all these different prescriptions in an attempt to target all these different target symptoms of PTSD. So that's just one example of that was what spurred us to do this work, was we realized there's such an underserved area where we desperately need new treatments for PTSD, and pharmaceutical companies are not that motivated or maybe just not successful in finding new treatments. Mm-hmm. And so since we had this mountain of anecdotal evidence from patients, particularly military veterans, but all sorts of patients were coming forward claiming that they were getting benefit from this plant. And I was very skeptical, you know, when they first started disclosing to me about 15 years ago that they were using this plant to treat a variety of ailments. You know, I was really dubious because I'd been trained in a really conservative medical environment where you don't view anything as a medicine unless it's been put through the entire FDA drug development process. So it took me years of hearing their reports, especially collateral history from other family members that were confirming that this plant was benefiting their loved one. And I, you know, it took me a long time to really view this plant as a medicine. But, you know, finally, when you looked at the scientific literature, there was already an enormous amount, you know, thousands of controlled trials that had already been published in peer-reviewed medical journals that were suggesting that cannabis had benefits. So that's when I started to opened my mind a little bit. And I would say I'm still a skeptic. You know, I'm a scientist, so until we see data from randomized controlled trials that are really developing practice parameters, it's going to be tough for me. But the bottom line is, yeah, we do have an epidemic of veteran suicide, and suicide in general is, you know, we see the rates of suicide rising in CDC data, and it is really concerning for all of us in the medical community, because we don't have enough tools in the arsenal to deal with this. We've got some very mediocre pharmaceuticals that target maybe one symptom or another, but don't really target the whole constellation of symptoms, whether it's depression, anxiety, PTSD, all of these things that are promoting suicidal thinking. And the opioid epidemic is all part of that, where people are, you know, opioid, the reason people are turning to opioids isn't just to treat pain. Remember, the opioids have a natural biologic antidepressant action. So because opioids elevate people's mood, you see a lot of people abusing opioids who aren't treating pain at all, but are treating long-standing depression, long-standing insomnia, other things that are being quelled with the opioids. And we know, we already have published data showing that cannabis could substitute for opioids. There's, you know, really impressive trends that we're seeing in legal medical cannabis states, showing that patients who have cannabis as a safer alternative to opioids are choosing cannabis, and their lives are being saved by that. So we need to study this much more vigorously through controlled trials, but the trends are there. And given the seriousness of this opioid crisis, I think that it's sad to me that we're not studying cannabis more vigorously, because it seems to hold a lot of promise in all of those areas.
Well, Dr. Sisley, I want to sort of go back to the longevity of your commitment to advancing knowledge in this area. You said it's been about 15 years that you've been hearing the stories, and I know over the past decade you've been on a quest to advance research on the use of marijuana or medical marijuana in this country. And I have also read about the barriers you faced. You had to seek approval from the FDA, the DEA, other government entities to launch a research study, and then had the challenge of gaining access to government-approved cannabis to use in the study. Tell us about these challenges to research, and if you would, maybe, what is the gap that you were seeing? You referenced that there are thousands of studies out there. What's the gap in the research that you are seeing that you feel you and your colleagues particularly need to address in order to advance our understanding?
Yeah. The barriers to cannabis research, first of all, are way more severe than they are any other drug in Schedule I. So, you know, I think we all agree that cannabis being lumped into Schedule I is absurd in the first place. It doesn't belong in Schedule I. It's Schedule I drugs are drugs that the government deems have no medical benefit and severe addiction potential, and cannabis doesn't meet either of those criteria. So what's even more insane is that cannabis has more onerous barriers to research than any of the other drugs in Schedule I. So, and we know this firsthand, because MAPS, a nonprofit that does all the seminal studies on psychedelics over the last 30 years, you know, they've been attempting to do MDMA research side by side with cannabis research. And it's amazing that it's easier for them to study MDMA than it is cannabis, because there's several additional layers of government red tape that cannabis has been forced to deal with. For instance, this Public Health Service review that's been in place for, you know, four decades. It was a redundant review that occurred after we already had FDA approval. And that, you know, in our case, that delayed our study implementation for 3 years for no reason. They didn't require any protocol changes at the end of it. So finally, we managed to dismantle that with aggressive lobbying of our government. But there's still the most severe barrier to research is still this NIDA monopoly, the fact that you do have to buy cannabis study drug from the University of Mississippi, that there's still only one federally legal supply of cannabis for any of these controlled trials. And we feel like that's the biggest barrier to research because, you know, none of the other drugs in Schedule One have to go through a monopoly. Like when MAPS purchases MDMA for their studies, they can buy MDMA or LSD or psilocybin mushrooms from any research lab in the country. They don't have to go through NIDA to buy their study drug. And the problem is, you know, like for instance, if you're studying the efficacy of cannabis for a certain illness, traditionally NIDA has not appreciated studies looking at efficacy because the government has already told the public that cannabis has no medical benefit. So you tend to get put into an almost, you know, permanent review process. In our case, fortunately, you know, we had a ton of public support and the whole veterans community behind us. But
you did, you did run into some red tape on that as well in your pursuit. You finally received that government-sanctioned research cannabis from Mississippi. I forget if I read it correctly. It was frozen. And you had endured considerable backlash after calling attention to the problem. And your partnership with the University of Arizona came to an end. And then you picked yourself up and joined forces with Colorado State University. And obviously, I think most of our listeners know that's a state with the most liberal marijuana laws in the country. And there seems to be a shifting tide in the nation's marijuana laws. We certainly know out on the East Coast here, Massachusetts has just opened its doors. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about this shift to our listeners and what should researchers be considering as more states approve medical marijuana laws and as apparently more corporate entities seem eager to enter the industry.
You know, the crucial thing is that to be aware that there's many public universities that are still running scared from this work, even though the studies that we're doing are all federally legal. You know, when you do controlled trials on cannabis, you're getting FDA approval, IRB committee approval, and then, of course, the DEA Schedule One license to purchase cannabis from the government. So all these studies are legal, but yet universities are still fearful because they think it'll harm their federal grant dollars, you know, their ability to draw down federal money. But it's not true, and we have examples of tons of public universities that are already doing this work. Sadly, it shouldn't take any political courage to do this work, but if you function in really conservative states, like if you're in Alabama and you want your university to do cannabis research, given that their budgets are derived from electeds that are often conservative, and then you probably have a struggle trying to do that work in those states. And yeah, that's why we ended up getting funding from Colorado. So the thing that we were most proud of was that we actually kept the clinical trial in Arizona where it was originally conceived. The state of Colorado chose to fund the study at $2.1 million. But they allowed us to conduct the trial in Arizona. Typically, we would, you know, you would think we would be forced to go out of state, but luckily we were able, with the funding from Colorado, we were able to complete the trial. It's been a 10-year saga trying to get this study completed through immense public support. We've managed to get this thing across the finish line. So the final veterans will be completing the protocol in end of January. We should be unblinding all the data sometime in March. And so the good and the bad of cannabis will all be published hopefully by the end of this year. And we're approaching mainstream journals to try to get this information out to the public.
Well, Dr. Sissy, I know in some of the reports I've read, you've said that as a scientist, you don't value cannabis per se, you value the objective data on cannabis, which is a good approach from a research scientist point of view. But you've talked about the significant amount of anecdotal data on how veterans and others have been managing their PTSD symptoms through personal marijuana use. I think our listeners would be interested in hearing about how you constructed the study to produce that empirical data that you all have been working so hard to attain. Tell us more about the specifics of the study. I assume it's a randomized control trial. Maybe what kind of measures are you looking at?
You know, the study is actually a triple blind randomized control trial, which is one of the ways that we've attempted to eliminate any chance of human bias. So everybody's probably heard of double-blind trials, but in this case, the patients or the study subjects are all blinded. They have no idea what variety of cannabis they're receiving. Could be placebo, could be high THC or high CBD. The physician investigators, like me, don't have any idea what anybody's getting. And finally, the triple blind is that the independent rater, all these secondary tests that we're doing, all these independent raters are also blinded. Everybody's pretty much blinded in the study except one staff person is unblinded. And we deliberately decided on that design because the amount of effort it's taken us to get the study implemented and completed, we've had to function like activists, really. We wanted to just do the work and get the data mm-hmm. and get it out to the public. So we've been forced to adopt an aggressive posture. So that's why we were concerned that the public might perceive that we have some type of agenda here to make cannabis look good, and we don't. I mean, that's the one thing I really want to emphasize here. Our commitment is to getting the most objective, unassailable data and really understanding how does this plant work, how doesn't it work, where is this potentially detrimental to patients, and put all of the data into the public domain. You know, we're a nonprofit, so our commitment is trying to put all the data out there, the good and the bad, so everybody can understand, does this plant help with PTSD? And if not, then let's, abandon this, because right now the data is conflicting. Some of the data shows that cannabis is helpful. Some of it shows that it could be harmful to PTSD. So that's why we needed a definitive controlled trial to answer this more clearly. And if the data shows that cannabis is potentially beneficial, then trying to identify which strains or varieties might be best for treating this. That's another problem. And when we talked earlier about what's lacking in the science here, the biggest void I see is what we call strain science. It's trying to understand which strains or which phenotypes of cannabis are best for which illnesses. And I'm sure your listeners are aware that the plant, there's hundreds of different varieties of cannabis, and all of them have different clinical properties. So trying to understand that, which ones are best for which illnesses, is crucial.
We're speaking today with Dr. Sue Sisley, president of the Scottsdale Research Institute, practicing in internal medicine and psychiatry. Dr. Sisley is the site principal investigator in the only FDA-approved randomized control trial in the world examining the safety and efficacy of the whole plant marijuana in combat veterans with severe post-traumatic stress disorder. Dr. Sisley, while your current focus is researching cannabis and PTSD, the Scottsdale Research Institute is seeking to advance much larger scale studies on a number of other conditions, potentially treating everything from multiple sclerosis to Alzheimer's to autism, or at least investigating them. Could you help us understand more about the chemical compounds found in marijuana, and such as THC and the psychoactive compounds, and why it appears potentially promising for so many conditions, especially disorders of the brain and the nervous system?
Well, the plant is so complex. I mean, there's over 100 different phytocannabinoids in the plant. So we always talk about THC and CBD because they've been the best characterized so far. We know the most about them, but there's, 100 plus other cannabinoids that have been identified that we don't understand what is their clinical effects and how to harness them. And so that's part of what the research that's been blocked for so many decades could have, we could have known so much more about this plant by now. But ideally, if the work that we're trying to do to break this monopoly, to push the government to license other expert growers for research, is so essential to enabling the understanding of the plant to move forward. Because right now, the genetics that the University of Mississippi has is so limited. We can order a batch of high THC cannabis or high CBD, but those are all very broad strokes. A lot of us are interested in looking at other diverse cannabinoids like THCV or CBN or CBG, and these are all things that we can't currently get. So I'm hoping that you'll see a renaissance of cannabis research in this country where we can finally learn more about what all these other molecules do, and not just cannabinoids, but of course terpenes and flavonoids and all these molecules that are working synergistically in the plant to create what we call the entourage effect. But even that needs to be studied further to understand how to really harness that.
Dr. Sisley, in addition to all of your focus and work on advancing scientific research for medical marijuana, I know that you've also been very engaged as an early adopter of telemedicine in your clinical practice for almost a decade. Dr. Peter Yelilis, the president of the American Telemedicine Association, joined us on the show, I think just within this past year, and he noted the great promise that telemedicine holds, in particular for addressing unmet behavioral health needs in our country, along with so many other potential uses. Can you talk with us a bit about your experience utilizing telemedicine over the past decade and your perspective on how it may or may not have reduced barriers to care and led to better outcomes for the people that you were caring for?
Yeah, no question that telemedicine has been a crucial step in providing distance care. You know, especially here in Arizona, we've got patients that are, you know, that are so remote. They're 5-6 hours away from the main city centers, and we've got, you know, over 30% of our land in Arizona is tribal land. So we have particularly a lot of Native American populations that are, they're really underserved on medical care. And it's really hard to persuade physicians or other allied health professionals to work out in such remote areas. So in those cases, you know, telemedicine is the only method of getting care to them. And it's been a wonderful experience. At first I was concerned that I wouldn't be able to have that kind of rapport that you get from being in, you know, an exam room with a patient one-on-one, but I've been amazed at how well, you know, we can build that type of really high-quality doctor-patient relationship even over video and provide some really excellent medical care. It's very similar to what I'm providing in the in-person care in an exam room, because now we have all these different modalities. We have digital stethoscopes, digital otoscopes, digital, you know, all sorts of digital cameras to take pictures and follow people. You know, if somebody has a skin lesion, I can follow it continuously to see how it's progressing or regressing. I have the ability, you know, I'm obviously reviewing people's lab results electronically, and I can guide them easily on things like their diabetes care, their hypertension. So it's I found it really rewarding. I think feel like the patients who are getting care from such remote areas are super grateful for the fact that anybody's even able to pay attention to them and their needs. And so it's been, you know, really rewarding. And, you know, and we're finding uses in other crucial areas, just, you know, public health issues like correctional care. Providing care in the prisons and jails has been really important because their access to specialty care has been very limited, and it's been the source of a lot of lawsuits for these states. But telemedicine has stepped in those areas and been really useful.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Sue Sisley, president of the Scottsdale Research Institute and site principal investigator in the only FDA-approved randomized control trial in the world examining the safety and efficacy of the whole plant marijuana in combat veterans with PTSD. You can learn more about her work by going to sriresearch.org, or you can follow her on Twitter at Sue Sisley, S-I-S-L-E-Y. Dr. Sisley, thank you for your scientific dedication and perseverance and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Oh, thank you so much.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
The Affordable Care Act open enrollment period for most states runs from November 1st to December 15th. These are the 39 states using the healthcare.gov platform. And the signups are for insurance plans that begin in January 2019, the first year in which the individual mandate penalty will no longer be in effect. That's the penalty assessed if someone doesn't have insurance or qualify for an exemption from the penalty. So how many people have signed up for insurance so far? From November 1st through the 17th, 1.9 million people have selected insurance plans, according to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which releases weekly updates during the open enrollment period. Those 1.9 million people include nearly 1.5 million consumers who are renewing their coverage and nearly 500,000 who are new consumers for healthcare.gov plans. The total number is down a bit from last year when nearly 2.3 million had selected plans from November 1st through the 18th, a similar time period. All told, plan selections are down by 352,603 compared with last year. The open enrollment, again, runs until December 15th, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services won't release a final report on the total enrollments for ACA exchange plans in all states for several months. In last year's open enrollment period, a total of 11.8 million people selected or were re-enrolled in exchange plans. That includes 8.7 million people in the healthcare.gov states, and another 3 million in states that use their own enrollment systems. That total figure was down by 400,000 from the previous year. Since the ACA exchanges launched for the 2014 plan year, the total enrollment peaked at 12.7 million people for insurance plans in effect for 2016. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, Managing Editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Stanford-based bioengineer Manu Prakash has a simple goal. He wants to create a portable medical lab small enough to fit in a backpack, and he's already developed a tool that fits the bill. While sitting under a tree in Uganda, he noticed that the local medical clinic's door was propped open by an expensive centrifuge machine, one that was reliant on electricity, now broken and no longer in use. And he wondered, how could he create a portable centrifuge that would be inexpensive to make, easy to operate, and easy to replace? His inspiration came from a simple ancient childhood toy, the whirligig, a toy that functions by pulling two ends of a string threaded through a round object like a button.
Before us, nobody had actually understood how this toy works. So we spent a significant portion of this time truly understanding the mathematical phase space for how you can convert linear motion into rotational motion. And there's some beautiful mathematics hidden inside this object.
So he took this simple toy idea to another level, creating a human-powered centrifuge made from simple components: paper, twine, and plastic. Altogether, each paperfuge, as he calls it, can be constructed in under 2 minutes and costs only 20 cents. And yet, remarkably, it works extremely efficiently.
With this set of principles, we're able to essentially make a centrifuge that spins all the way to 120,000 RPM. In the lab, we can separate and pull out malaria parasites from blood, separate blood plasma. It is an ultra-low-cost centrifuge.
It's currently being tested for malaria diagnoses, but is being readied for far more complex diagnostic challenges.
This is a tool that requires no electricity, no infrastructure. You can carry them around in your pockets for a price point of 20 cents.
The paperfuge, a cheap but highly effective field tool for clinicians, providing a portable solution to diagnostic challenges, creating a quicker pathway to diagnosis and treatment. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. This show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.